Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 141 for comics originally released on April 21st, 2010. Starting us off in DC is Spirit Number 1. This is part of the First Wave initiative, and you know, we've loved First Wave. We, frankly, I think would be fair to say we hated Doc Savage Number 1.
Yeah. And everything they did bad in Doc Savage, they did right in the Spirit.
Overall, I liked it, but I've never been a huge Spirit fan. So I got a couple of questions here and there that just really show my lack of knowledge about the character. Starting with, has he always been based in Central City?
Yep.
Okay.
That's been from the beginning.
I kind of figured that was the case, but whenever I read about Central City, I expect to see the Flash, not the Spirit.
And this is a different Central City.
I know it's a different Central City, and frankly, this one came first. So
this one's on the water.
You know, I look at that first splash page, and they do the Will Eisner bit with the Spirit in the buildings and stuff. And they also did that on that third page with the panel borders.
Designs, yeah. Uh-huh.
And they also do it at the beginning of the backup story. And I get what they're going for, because that was really a trademark of Will Eisner's. But really, in none of these three places do I feel they do it anywhere near as artistically or effectively as he did. But I appreciate they're at least making that attempt. You know, I almost missed the bit with the panel layouts till I got to it. It's like, well, why are they so funny?
I liked it. I mean, it's not done by everyone who does the Spirit. And, you know, not everyone's Will Eisner. I do like Mora Tatt's art in general, especially his figures. He draws a really pretty Ellen Dolan, as a for instance.
Overall, I thought the art was really strong on this. I mean, I think your comment of not everyone's Will Eisner is a very good point. I mean,
nobody's Will Eisner. You know, it's like he wrote the book on a lot of this stuff. So I liked the fact that you're reading this story. They have some action. Spirit actually, you know, has kind of the voiceover. He kind of tells you who he is. He gives you a little bit of background. You have introductions to the characters and their motivations, even with the Octopus and his gang, that I don't see necessarily all the time. I certainly didn't see it last week, and I don't want to keep on referring back to that. But I thought that Mark Schultz, who's a very good writer in and of his own, you know, his own right, you know, just nailed telling a story that, to me, introduced all the elements of the story, moved the story along, and then, you know, kind of set us up, you know, at least set me up for, wow, I want to keep going with this. I want to see where the next issue is going to be bringing us Angel Smerti. So
I think part of this is, you're right. I mean, excellent job setting up the characters, the setting, naming all the characters, and really introducing everything. I thought this, in that respect, was a very good first issue. But there were one or two things that they did that took me out of the story. Just not massively, but enough to cause a little bump in the road, if you will. I mean, like little things like when the Spirit's talking to Dolan, and his last word balloon on that page for Dolan is, I don't know, like a bug or whatever in his word balloon. And I'm still not quite sure what the heck that was supposed to be. I mean, it was clearly intentional, and it was in place of profanity, maybe? I mean, that was the sort of thing that just took me out of the story a little.
I think he's implying that there's a bug in the office. That's why they're going out.
Because then they go outside. Okay,
then they go out to the restaurant. It's basically, it is bug. You know, that's exactly what that is. you know, because then he makes reference in the next panel that you can't even talk in your own office, you know, because his office is bugged.
That makes perfect sense. I missed that entirely while reading it. And that's as much me as anything else. Overall, I like this. I thought it was good. I was entertained by this issue, but it failed to completely hook me. But frankly, I've had that with the Spirit even when Will Eisner was doing it. So I think it's just, there's something about the Spirit that intrinsically fails to hook me, and that's not to say anything negative about the property. Not all properties are for all people. I think that certainly when Will Eisner was doing it, it was, I mean, very, very, very well done. In this case, I thought it was a very good, like I said, first issue, good introduction. It got me interested enough. I'm going to give it a couple of more issues. I want to give this a fair shake. I think this was a very solid story, and I want to see where it goes. But it's not one of those where I went in with a predisposition towards the character, didn't come out with one either. But, you know, I'm along for the ride. I think this is, again, much better than the Doc Savage stuff. Not as good as First Wave, but a good companion to First Wave, I think. So
I thought it was as well done as any post Eisner Spirit that I've seen. And I've pretty much read them all. I mean, I read the run that DC just finished up. I read the Kitchen Sink stuff, the New Adventures of the Spirit. There's been other people, and even Eisner himself didn't do his own Spirit strip when he was away in the war. So, I mean, I think Schultz is doing a good job on it.
And I agree with that.
He's really capturing it, and I think that you kind of get down to it that, you know, you've read other versions of the Spirit, and it's just not something that really kind of grabs you. I think that
I think what I'm saying is that I haven't read all that many other versions of the Spirit, including that much of Eisner's, because I don't find the character that interesting.
Right. So what I'm saying is somebody can read this, mm-hmm. and if they like it, they can be relatively assured that, you know, they'll like, you know, the Spirit, I think. And if you don't like it, you know, it's probably just like you said, you know, the Spirit's just not something for you, which it isn't for everybody.
Yeah.
And nothing's going to hit for everybody.
And again, I didn't dislike this, and I certainly don't want to give anyone that impression, but if I had to only have 10 titles on my list, don't know that this would have made it. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure it would not have, but if I had to cut 10 titles that are on my list out of the tons I've got, this wouldn't make that list by a long shot either. I thought the backup feature, which was a black and white Spirit story written by Denny O'Neill with art by Sienkiewicz, that one I had some problems with, and part of it's I just don't like that art style. And there was an aspect of, I'm going to go with the scribbliness to the art. I mean, the whole bit with the Spirit again being spelled out in the top row of panels on that story was almost completely lost on me. But, you know, it's like, oh, I guess that's what they're doing. And I didn't really care for the backup feature much at all. It felt rushed and unfinished.
The backup was not something that I was that enthused about. Sienkiewicz's really loose abstract style is not one that I'm particularly enthused with. I didn't dislike it. It was an okay story. It wasn't enhanced by that art for me personally, but there are people who really enjoy this art style by Sienkiewicz. So, you know, it'd be worth checking out for those people. You know, anyone who's a huge Bill Sienkiewicz fan, they should really check out this issue because it does have that backup feature.
I like that the backup feature was a Spirit feature. You know, I don't know what else they could have tossed in here, but I think they're doing well by Eisner, and they're treating the character with respect and doing some good stuff. And I'm hoping that I'll warm to it over a couple of issues.
Thing I liked about it is it just felt in the vein of other Spirit that I've read. It did not come off to me like, you know, what in the world is this that I'm reading? Did these people not even bother to, you know, understand the character that they're writing and, you know, stay true to it? This is really true to the Spirit. I thought they did a really good job. So
yeah, it certainly felt very respectful. Yeah,
I gave it a very high 4. It was the backup feature that kind of pulled it down a bit for me. If it had been all Mark Schultz and Moritat, I would have given it a 5.
I can see that. I can see that. gave it a 3 myself. Again, the backup feature kind of pulled it down for me. And again, I don't have any, you know, predisposition towards the Spirit. But I do think this was a very, you know, again, well done first issue. It set the scene, introduced everything. And, you know, this was a hard sell. I mean, just in a couple of respects in terms of somebody else doing, you know, Eisner's work or whatever. Like you said, it's been done before or whatever, but there are opportunities to go wrong, and they didn't. You know, they treated it respectfully. They did a good job. They told a good story, and I respect that. And, you know, again, I want to see where they go with this, and like I said, I hope I warm to it more than I have so far.
Next up, we've got the end of the monthlies, at least for now, for Marvel Cosmic. We've got Guardians of the Galaxy number 25 and Nova number 36. This one kind of crept up on me because they didn't really say they were being canceled, and maybe they're just going on hiatus, but both of these issues ended with end, or in case of Nova, never the end. And, you know, they say, you know, follow the story in the Thanos Imperative Ignition that's on sale in May. So we'll have that. I'm just curious, you know, after the Thanos Imperative is over, what are they going to do with these titles? Nova has joined the Secret Avengers from some of the ads that I've seen. So I'm suspecting that, and they're setting him up to be working with Project Pegasus. So I think he's going to be based on Earth again with Project Pegasus, which would preclude, you know, going back to the cosmic Nova Corps aspect of that character. So
it's conceivable he could somehow do both, but it'd be a little difficult. But whenever they say they're putting something on hiatus, I mean, they said that with Immortal Iron Fist, which never came back.
Yeah, it's been about a year now.
Yeah.
Seems like it.
Long enough that it had time to come back and then some. So I get frustrated when they do that, because I've really been enjoying Nova. I've been liking Guardians of the Galaxy. I think this was a better issue than some of the recent ones. Certainly the art was a lot better. And I'm sorry to see both these titles go, particularly with no guarantee they're coming back. But
now, if you look at the sales of them, though, they've been not burning up the charts. I mean, they weren't, like, really low, but they weren't really strong either.
Yeah, but a lot of things don't burn up the charts, so.
Right. I'm just wondering if this is kind of like a new, you know, we're getting kind of a new bar set by Marvel.
That's possible, but I'd be, frankly, a bit surprised by that. These titles were selling, see, Nova was selling around 21,407 with issue 35, which is the next to last issue. And then Guardians of the Galaxy is selling 21,643 units with issue 24, which is just prior to this. Both of those are not bad. I mean, they're doing better than the Realm of Kings titles, better than Avengers vs. Atlas, X-Men Forever. I guess that's not saying a whole lot. But I mean, they're you know, I don't think they're doing horrible. Can they do better than these? Yes.
Sure. I mean, and that's, you know, they're in the low, you know, close to 20, just a hair over 20, right? What's interesting is I looked the same thing at the trade sales on these books, and both of them are selling under 2,000 copies. So, you know, when people say they're waiting for the trade, would, you know, if they cancel this and, you know, some, I know there's, I wouldn't even say a lot. I mean, it's like there are some certainly very vocal minority on the internet that talks about, you know, how they prefer getting trade paperbacks and, you know, how they wish that the monthlies would go away and all this kind of stuff. But frankly, I really don't see if the monthlies went away, a trade paperback of one of these books selling 21,000 copies.
Well, it's hard to say, because I think part of why they're not selling the way they are now on the trade side is because people like us have gotten the monthlies. And the few times we've seen original to trade or original to hardcover material, those have often sold pretty well. You look back at some of the Alex Ross, Paul Dini stuff they did, Justice League Earth 2, and the few things like that. And, you know, they would sell, again, I'd have to, with the Alex Ross Dini stuff, I'm thinking in the 30,000s or whatever.
Yeah, well, that's Alex Ross.
Agreed. It was also fewer pages, etc., bigger size. certainly not an apples to apples. I would think, though, if they went straight to trade, those sales would probably be at least double, maybe triple. Would it make up for the lack of a monthly? Certainly not. Because the trade would then also have to be higher priced to cover the fact that nothing else had paid for the content creation. At one point, I was thinking we were going to go to a trade-heavy industry at some point, and that would take over as the primary format. I'm just not seeing that these days anymore. The sales aren't there, really, on either side of the equation. But at least with both of these titles, they gave us a clean sense of closure while also giving us a good lead-in into the Thanos Imperative. And the fact they put that on the title, or the cover of both above the title, I thought was a smart move. And, you know, again, overall, I thought this was a good closing issue for the series. Hopefully it'll come back. But things like seeing the Council of the Guardians of all the galaxies, I thought that was kind of cool. It was also a good use of the original Guardians of the Galaxy from the future.
And I liked I don't want to give it away, but what Star-Lord does, right?
Mm-hmm.
What he pulls out, and, you know, he saves the day for this series and sets up the Thanos Imperative to happen. It's not like what they could have done is just lead up, and then end on a cliffhanger with them in terrible peril and, oh, go read the Thanos Imperative to, you know, get the rest of the story. And they didn't do that, which I appreciated.
Oh, I mean, it could have been even worse. They could have just told whatever story they had, and at the last page, they turn around and there's Thanos or whatever, you know, completely unrelated. But, I mean, you're right. This was an integral lead-up to the Thanos Imperative in a very, it felt organic, a lead-up to that.
And it stood on its own. It told you, you know, it completed the story of this incarnation of Guardians of the Galaxy. And I thought, you know, issue 25 ended here on a good point where you get a sense of closure for the series, which is a good thing. I thought this was one of the better issues, and Abnett and Lanning did an excellent job on this.
Yeah, but they've been doing a great job on pretty much all of the cosmic stuff lately, and I hope they get a chance to continue doing that.
Which is just makes it sad that, you know, they're not selling well enough to keep on publishing the stuff.
Well, I'm not convinced they got to that point where they're so low they had to cancel it. They may have other things Abnett and Lanning want to do. There may be other things other than just sales. The sales certainly aren't good enough to say, oh, they've got to keep doing this. But, you know, we've got other titles selling a lot worse that show no end of in sight.
Yeah, I just look at the list and it should be selling 50,000 copies, you know, because it's that good. It's better than a lot of the books that are selling more copies than it does. That's all I'm saying. At least from my opinion and from my enjoyment of these books, they're significantly better than a lot of the books that come up higher than them. I mean, these are ranked down in the, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy's down around 79, 80 in the rank. You know, it should be a top 20, top 30 book.
I certainly think it has that potential, but frankly, some recent issues of Guardians of the Galaxy, I thought the art was atrocious. So, I mean, I can also see part of why recently it hadn't been doing all that well. But it also looked like it had stabilized where it was at, so. The thing that gets me is here are two titles that both of us had on our pull list, and pretty much, I think, had things continued, you know, on par, in other words, no radical change in or drop in quality, we'd have kept going with pretty much forever. But now, since they've stopped both titles, they're off our pull list. They're replacing both of these with the Thanos Imperative that, frankly, if these titles had continued, we'd have been getting anyways. So all they've really done is cut off two revenue streams. You know, and that's the part that I just think is counterproductive. But, you know, I'm sure they've got some great plan and it all makes sense in their heads. I just don't see it. But, again, looking forward to the Thanos Imperative. Abnett and Lanning are doing some great stuff. Anyone who hasn't been checking out the Marvel Cosmic stuff, I think should definitely do so, either in the monthly issues or picking up the trades for the back stuff.
Yeah. Well, maybe they're just pinching it off, hopefully, and then, you know, just to get the extra sales, they'll relaunch them with new number ones after the Thanos Imperative is over.
And I'd be all for that. I just will wonder how many readers make that transition, particularly if they move Nova to be Earthbound or make other changes, or who knows what's happening in Thanos Imperative.
Yeah.
So it just seems every time they kind of cut the cord there, even if they restart the titles, it's a risk because I think more people are liable to jump off than jump on in the long term. Certainly people, like with the Green Arrow flipping that they're doing over in DC, with the one title ending and the other one starting up a month or two later, they're going to see a bump on the number ones, but really, within a couple issues, it's going to be back where it was for the most part. At least that's what usually happens.
What's interesting to me is, I don't know, the demographic of people who buy Marvel comics. I mean, it used to be, you know, I'm going back way a long time, you know, where you'd have, but this is not the real Marvel zombies that they have in the lately miniseries that come out endlessly. But, you know, back in the 70s, they had Marvel zombies that were the fans who would buy everything that Marvel put out. And, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, you know, maybe even into the 90s, it was possible to buy everything that Marvel put out. And you could read everything and it all kind of hung together. But now that they're doing these increasingly, say, diversified line of stuff, I don't think you have that sense of brand loyalty, and people are now used to just getting some certain niches of Marvel. You know, like you have just very fragmented Marvel comics. You know, you have the X-Universe kind of keeps to itself to a large extent, doesn't do a lot of crossing over with the other stuff. You've got the Marvel Cosmic stuff, which was good, but I think it was just, it was enough disconnected that a lot of people just, even though it was good, they just never bothered with it. You know, they didn't know about it. They didn't try it. You have the Ultimate stuff. You've got the noir stuff. You've got the, you know, Marvel Adventures stuff. You've, you know, just there's so many different corners.
They've definitely Marvel. Compartmentalized their universe and fractured along those lines. Because, I mean, back in that time frame you were talking about, you pretty much had a very cohesive Marvel universe. What happened over in FF would get referenced over in some other title. And hell, there were times where there were, I don't say in-jokes, but almost fighting between some of the writers where, you know, somebody would do something with Doctor Doom, somebody would not like it, so they'd kind of invalidate that in the story, or vice versa. You know, whereas now, you could have, you know, characters showing up in certain titles, you know, that come out in the same week that really have nothing to do with each other. And, you know, I think people could still buy everything in the mainstream Marvel universe today, and that's still more than they were publishing back then, probably by a factor of two, I would think, and follow it. But because it lacks that cohesiveness, there's less incentive to do it. And, you know, that's bad branding on their part, I think, to a degree. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. But I also think with this flipping of the Avengers titles and the restarting of one of the X-Men books and kind of the rebranding over there, retooling, that we're maybe going to see Spider-Man having a bit more to do with some of the X-Men characters, some of the X-Men characters having a bit more to do with the Avengers. It looks like the Thing's going to be a member of one of the team, so that gets the Fantastic Four. It looks like they may be making a concerted effort to kind of get the main Marvel Universe a bit more cohesive. Now, you'll still have the Ultimate line over in the corner, you know, the noir line in its own reality and all that stuff. But it's possible that they're acknowledging that phenomena you're mentioning and working to do something about it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I was enjoying the Cosmic books kind of being off on their own corner. But then again, you know, if there's a lot of people that, since they're off on the side, they won't even bother with it, you know, even if it's done really well.
It's a fine line, though, to have a shared universe that leverages being shared without making people feel like they're obligated to buy everything in it or be hopelessly confused. And the writers that can juggle that, make the individual titles stand on their own while taking advantage of having that bigger canvas to work on, you know, again, like Abnett and Lanning have been doing in the Cosmic sector, that's, you know, to me, what really makes for a strong title.
Yeah.
And I think our next book is a good example of that, too.
Yeah, so what was your rating on Guardians?
I'm going with a 4. I thought it went out with a good, solid ending. And, you know, again, the art improved over recent issues, which was my main beef with the title recently. How about you?
I gave it a 5. I loved this issue. I thought it was one of the best issues that had been done in a while, and I, you know, I'm just ranking this issue in and of itself. I thought it had solid art and a great story, a great ending, and summed up the series well.
Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah. So for Magdalena, you've been reading most of the Top Cow books that kind of tie into this Ron Marzaverse over there. I haven't. So I kind of picked up this Magdalena. I picked up the Angelus series.
I've only read the first issue of that. I have 2 and 3, but haven't read them yet.
Yeah. And, you know, but I have not read the previous Magdalena series. What I liked about this first issue was, I mean, I'm kind of aware of the character. I mean, I know what the basic premise is of the character, but I have not read probably any of the previous, maybe a couple here and there. I've picked up some previous incarnations or issues here and there of Magdalena books. But I thought he did a really good job in this issue of setting the stage of who the character is. Again, you know, who it is, what are the motivations, what's going on, moving the story along a little bit and leaving me off with a point of like, well, that's pretty cool. I think I need to pick up the next issue now and see what happens, which you can't hope for more out of a first issue.
I would agree with that. I mean, I've been reading some of the stuff they've been doing lately with the Broken Trinity and whatnot. But really, aside from the Broken Trinity and the follow-up to that, the first issue of Angelus and stuff, I'm not that deep right now into the Top Cow stuff. But I thought this was an incredibly solid first issue. Like you said, it really set the stage. It set up the scene, the characters, and there are quite a few of the characters. I mean, there are a lot of characters here. It set up the conflicts between them and how they interplay. Now, it did this with some exposition here and there, but it worked and it moved the story along. And frankly, I really appreciated the exposition about who and what Magdalena is, was, and all that stuff, because I've read about the character before, but never really got that core aspect of it. You know?
I came away from it feeling like he really did a great job of explaining, you know, who the character is, what she's all about, and, you know, now I'm ready to roll, you know, and I've been picking up Witchblade. It's just on my to-be-read pile, you know, probably got about a year's worth of it that I've been picking it up. And now I'm going to be pulling it out and reading it because, you know, Mars is doing a really good job on this. You know, this and the Angelus and, you know, a lot of that stuff that I had not been reading, he did enough of a job on this that not only am I going to be willing to keep reading keep reading Magdalena here, but I'm going to really go out of my way to check out the other books he's writing that kind of, you know, tie into this.
Yeah, I mean, based on the strength of this, I was thinking that, you know, I may need to go pick up some back issues of Witchblade and some stuff like that and to get further into the Top Cow universe. Because, I mean, Ron Mars is just knocking stuff out of the park on a consistent basis here. I mean, the artwork here by Nelson Blake, too, really nice, clean, good style, and I felt like this issue just had a ton of story in it, covered a lot of ground, and really hooked me. And I know this kind of fits in what you would consider the DC school of advertising, where you get kind of a cryptic ad, but the two-page spread for Artifacts in the middle, I liked. I thought that was cool. You know, we see the Witchblade, the Darkness Mask, the two little pendants or whatever from the Broken Trinity, a couple of other things that I'm not entirely sure what are off the top of my head, but it's
well,
like...
interestingly, I recognize various things from it. I mean, I don't know too much, but I mean, I felt that it was less cryptic than some of those DC ones are often, you know, because I think the DC ones kind of go out of their way to be cryptic.
Yeah, well, and this was,
you know, because there's so many people who are hardcore DC fans, because, I mean, I recognize this little Darkling character hangs out with the Darkness and the Darkness Mask and the Witchblade, and weren't these two amulets here?
That's, again, from the Broken Trinity, like I was just saying, yeah.
We read that Pandora's Box one, and yeah, those were featured in that.
As was the sword in the background. The
yeah,
big thing with the necklace on it, I think was mentioned maybe in there too. I mean, to me, you're right, it's not trying to be overly cryptic, and this is definitely a teaser ad, but it was an effective one for me.
It's yeah. Like, oh yeah. Well, like I said, I looked at it and said, oh, it looks cool. And actually really nice art too. So it just got me like, I want to read the Artifact series when it comes out.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm liking is all of these different things, you know, Magdalena, Angelus, the Broken Trinity stuff, both the original one and the Pandora's Box. And then there was one other, don't they have something else going right now? Miniseries, I'm forgetting the name of it. Anyways, all of these are playing into the same universe. They're different, I don't say aspects of the same storyline because they're not, but they're circling around each other in various ways. So you can see that there are connections, but not so mired in them that it's like, oh geez, now I gotta go pick up something else. They're all standing alone very well, and individually are each very strong titles. And because they're all strong, and they're all, again, orbiting each other, it makes for what I think is a very strong and interesting universe. A lot of that, I think, goes to Ron Mars. He's covering a lot of ground, a lot of characters, but doing so very effectively and, you know, entertainingly.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. He's really carved out a niche for himself here and is doing a really good job on it.
Yeah. Well, and again, I look at an issue like this. Yes, it was 24 pages versus the average 22. But even if you take out the two-page scene at the end, which I think was very much needed, but, you know, not count that in the amount of story, this had like four times as much story as, say, the first issue of The Hulk or some of the others that we've read that it were exceedingly light on story. You know, this felt like a very satisfying chunk of story, and I felt like I got my money's worth out of it, and I wish more comics were that way.
Well, it was those last four pages that really planted the hook. You know, it was like two-page scenes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like where Magdalena is at the restaurant and the waiter, you know, does what the waiter does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of got me biting at the hook. And then the next two pages that happened in the Ukraine, that set the hook to be, wow, I need to keep reading the story and see what happens next.
Well, what I liked is certainly that last scene at the end wasn't so much foreshadowed but set up, as was some of what happened in the scene prior to that. In other words, I felt like that was not only teasers for what happens next issue and something to pick me up and grab me and pull me into that next issue, but also payoff within this issue from stuff that had happened earlier.
Right.
You know, and to me that's highly effective writing when those scenes are doing kind of double duty there. And that's not something I'm seeing in a lot of the comics I read. So definitely this gets high marks. Love the art, love the story. This was a 5 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, I gave it a 5 also. It, you know, the fact that it not only, and again, it was an excellent use and an excellent presentation of a first issue, but the fact that it not only got me interested in reading the rest of this series,
yeah,
but that it got me interested in going and reading the other Top Cow titles that are related to this that Mars is writing. And that's an accomplishment, and, you know, something that, you know, Mars can be proud of, I think, at least, you know, from that, because he did a really compelling job on this. So,
yeah, well, and again, this is, I think he's being very consistent in that regard with the Broken Trinity, Pandora's Box, and some of the other stuff he's been doing over there, because I think we've been feeling this way about a lot of what he's doing. So I think he's a very talented writer who, you know, obviously isn't getting the recognition he deserves. You know, if he were doing this over at Marvel and DC because they've got more readers, you know, I think he'd be getting a lot more buzz around him. But good stuff. So what else did you read?
I read, let's see, I read the Sif one-shot that came out, Doom War. I thought Doom War number 3 was a really good issue.
I haven't gotten to that one yet, but yeah.
I was extremely impressed with it. They did something with Dr. Doom that fundamentally kind of shifts how you'll look at Dr. Doom from now on.
Interesting.
I liked it. I thought it was really well done. I read the Justice League issue, the Green Lantern Brightest Day issue, I thought was really well done also.
I thought that was good. The other thing I read along those lines was I got the Blackest Night director's cut. That was a $6 comic, and it was a very different approach to a director's cut than a lot of what we've seen before, where you'd pretty much get the same basic comic and about 8 pages of fluff at the end. This was kind of a two-column deal, where in the right column of the page, you'd get, you know, small reprints of the pages or panels, that in the left column, you're getting the voiceover director commentary like you'd actually get on a DVD.
Hmm.
And they covered all 8 issues. Then they showed a couple of scenes they cut, and...
So they did this one book, had like all 8 issues, kind of like really small, with the director's commentary for the whole thing?
The relevant pages.
Okay.
So you don't
maybe
have,
I'll have
all
to check that out.
8 in there. But, you know, it's like, oh, we're talking about when this happened, and you see when that happened. Now, it's really tiny. It's, you know, not necessarily where you can quite make out the words, but almost, you know, it depends how, maybe you can if your eyesight's better than mine, I guess. But it gives you the, oh, yeah, that's what they're talking about stuff. And sometimes they go closer in on a panel and stuff, and really, it's like, oh, this is what he's doing with showing the Flash being so fast, he can be in kind of two places at once, sort of a thing. And, you know, it was really cool, because they had the whole creative team, you know, the you know, writer, pencilist, colorist, all of which did, you know, great work on that series in there with the editor, just kind of talking about it. Again, like you would have on the commentary track for a DVD. But then at the end, they've got the kind of thumbnail, not thumbnail, I don't say a who's who, but a mini kind of dossier section or whatever on the various Black Lanterns. Now, I did notice what I think was one mistake in there, but it was really cool seeing all the different Black Lanterns in their costume and get a, this guy can do so-and-so, here's when he died, and things like that. And it makes her a really good companion to the Blackest Night stuff. I've been getting some director's cut stuff. There were others that I thought were really underwhelming. This is one that, even at the $5.99 cover price, I think pretty much justified itself if you're into that sort of thing and you liked Blackest Night.
I would have wanted to get it. I was kind of shying away from it because I figured ultimately I'll get the Absolute, and the Absolute would have that in it. But, you know, that'll be a couple of years from now. Another thing that I got this week was the Green Lantern Rebirth Absolute. It came out, and that's a very nice package.
Cool.
I spent some time rereading and looking at the special features in that. Nice package. A little pricey, though. And it was only the 6-issue Rebirth series, and they had a couple of other stories in there. But, you know, $75, at least I got it for, I think, half off, so that wasn't that bad. But $75 would be a little stiff for that book.
Yeah, yeah.
Power Girl was good.
I like that. I thought that was very interesting. I'm disappointed that they're going to be flipping the creative team in the not-too-distant future. Because I'm really liking what this creative team is doing on that book. It's funny for it to be coming out concurrently with Supergirl, in this case, both on the same week, and they're such different titles.
And, you know, that's just Amanda Connor can't really do a monthly book. She's been, like, doing it for a year is killing her. So, you know, and then Jimmy and Justin are just, you know, if she's going to leave the book, we're going to leave the book, kind of solidarity.
And I can see that, but I'd almost rather they would take it to a series of miniseries or something. I'd rather be getting, and this is harsh to say because maybe the next team will be brilliant, but I'd almost rather see 4 issues of this a year to where they have time to do some other stuff or whatever by this creative team, and let them take a little more time to do those 4, or versus some other creators come in and really kind of, you know, suck the life out of the title.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens. Maybe it'll be brilliant.
Oh, I will mention, I don't know if you got it and read it or not. I got this review copy of The Angry Penguin.
I got it. I have not had time to read it.
I'm not sure if it'll be up your alley or not. So I'll be curious. I kind of liked it. It was, it's a mini comic, and it, you know, it's certainly self-published. You can find out about it at theangrypenguin.com. I was amused by it. It was funny. The penguin's kind of weird. He's a little hairier than I'd expect a penguin to be, and he's got like big sharp teeth and stuff. He doesn't look like, you know, like a penguin that you see in a Disney cartoon or something like that, or, you know, when Bugs Bunny goes and sees a penguin. Looks nothing like that. I mean, he's black and white, but other than that, he's like this violent, angry penguin, and he's, like, doing crazy stuff. He's, like, you know, chopping heads off of things with a machete. And
yeah, that might not be to my taste.
Fighting crazy Russian guys and, you know, just, you know, going out in space and cursing. And, you know, I was pleasantly amused by the whole thing. It might not be your cup of tea, but I think that it was certainly nicely done, and there's an audience for it out there. I would recommend, you know, people who like what could I compare it to? You know, if you like kind of humorous violence, you know, almost like Bugs Bunny taken to extreme, you know, where it's just like, you know, crazy stuff happening continually. It's, you know, and he drinks too, so it just. It's some, you know, kind of a, I think teenagers and, you know, up would enjoy this. So it's worth having a look at. We can put a link in the show notes for people to check it out, though.
Cool. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for me. We're going to play a promo for the Phoenix Comic Con that's coming up, and I'll be there over Memorial Day weekend. And it's a nice, smaller con for people who are in the Southwest to check out.
Cool.
Phoenix Comic Con, the signature pop culture event of the Southwest, is coming Memorial Day weekend. Grab your friends, grab your family, and come enjoy a long weekend of fun May 27th through 30th at the Phoenix Convention Center. A full weekend pass includes the exclusive Thursday preview night excitement. Special guests include Streamy Award winner Felicia Day, Todd McFarland and Craig Capullo, and the legend, the creator, the Cameo King, Stan the Man Lee. Pre-order your Stan Lee autograph now. Can't make it to Thursday preview night? There's so much to do all weekend, we spilled over into the neighboring Hyatt. Hotel events include playing rock band with geek legend Will Wheaton, a special concert by James Marsters, and much, much more. Book a room at the Hyatt and stay close to the action. So come on out to meet your favorite artists. Catch some films during our four-day film festival, gaming, and vendor extravaganza. Create your own experience with Conquest, your personal convention planner. More information can be found at www.phoenixcomiccon.com.
Join us next week when we discuss Garrison number 1 from DC Wildstorm, Iron Man number 25 from Marvel, and The Last Unicorn number 1 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.